welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment. We talk about policy, advocacy, movement building, and science on the show with different experts and thought leaders, activists and advocates, scientists, doctors, politicians, journalists, and everyone who is working with some sector of our interconnected world that relates to our health, our well-being, the well-being of our communities, of our society, and the ecological balance of our ecosystem here on planet Earth. And so we talk to different people every week about that. And this week I'm really psyched because we're going to be discussing a long-standing area that we have treated many times in many programs on Connect the Dots, and getting an amazing and sort of slightly shocking update on some very major new developments in the area of GMOs. We've talked about GMOs. We've spent many hours talking about the science of it, trying to regulate them, trying to label them, and all the rest of it. And, you know, there are many people who were very passionate about this. Other people were like, ho-hum, there's nothing wrong with, you know, genetic engineering. I don't know what you're talking about. So with the new material, which some of you may be aware of, that has come to light through a lawsuit this year, we are looking at a whole different landscape, which now stands revealed. And joining us on today's show to discuss that is Stacy Malkin, the co-founder and co-director of U.S. Right to Know, which is a nonprofit public interest consumer and public health research group working for transparency and accountability in our nation's food system. Stacy is also the author of the award-winning book, Not Just a Pretty Face, The Ugly Side of the Beauty Industry, and she was a co-founder of the National Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, a coalition of nonprofit health and environmental groups that has prompted major cosmetics manufacturers to remove hazardous ingredients from nail polish, baby products, makeup, and hair products. Thank you, Stacy.
Thank you, Allison. I'm so glad to be here with you. I really appreciate your work. And, yeah, we've got a lot to talk about today.
Yep, we really do. So, you know, you've just been involved in some awesome things. And over the last, you know, almost a year, there's been a major turning on the GMO front. So, you know, for any listeners that are not following this and unaware of it, you know, Stacy, if you could fill our listeners in on what has been going on over the past epoch period with the Monsanto lawsuits.
Sure. Well, so as many of you have heard, Monsanto, which is now owned by Bayer, after some really significant consolidations in the chemical industry that have brought the control of our food system into the hands primarily of three companies, and that's Monsanto and Bayer and then Dow DuPont and Syngenta ChemChina. So I want to mention that because I think we're really looking at an entire industry of concern regarding who owns and controls and makes decisions about our food system. What's happened in the last year with Monsanto and Bayer is that many, many, many documents have come to light through lawsuits about how these corporations operate behind the scenes, about how they manipulate science, hide the health effects of their products, work with scientists, professors, academics, and journalists who they deploy with their messaging, while on the other hand, attacking and trying to discredit scientists, journalists, advocates who raise concerns about their products. So it's really a full-scale disinformation campaign that they've been waging around their products. And this is coming up around glyphosate, which many of us know as Roundup, you know, the herbicide weed killer in Home Depot, in all the in the stores. You can buy it, you can put it all over your yard, and therefore people think it must be safe. And I've actually had Allison, and my reporting goes back many decades, too. I think we've both been looking at these issues for so many years, and I've had, town councilmen and city managers tell me, Roundup is safe. It must be safe because you can buy it in Walmart, so therefore it's safe. So this is sort of the thinking that, you know, somebody's making sure this stuff is safe. Well, it turns out there's a lot of scientists have been raising concerns for many years about the cancer links to glyphosate, and that has been the subject of these trials. The third trial just wrapped up in Oakland, and all three trials so far have returned with unanimous jury verdicts saying that glyphosate was a substantial cause of the plaintiffs developing non-Hodgkin lymphoma cancers, and that Monsanto knew and covered up the risks and failed to warn people. And that's a really key point, because this recent couple in Oakland, the Pilliads, it was a husband and wife who both contracted non-Hodgkin lymphoma, both sprayed glyphosate for years and years in their yard, just wearing flip-flops and shorts, no protection, no breathing masks, because the company never gave any of those kinds of warnings. They presented this chemical as if it was benign and safe and good for the environment. And it turns out the evidence was there that that's not so. So that's
when
what's coming out in the trial.
When you say the evidence was there, Stacey, where was the evidence? Because, you know, the public PR statements were, it's safe, it's safe, it's safe, whenever independent scientists from Europe studied, did animal studies or studied this and, you know, found other disturbing effects, you know, then they were denigrated and confused and, you know, and derided. And it was like even very difficult for bona fide medical health publications or scientific publications to actually publish the findings. And they even were pressured to doctor them. So, you know, where was this information hiding that, in fact, it was not safe?
Right. Well, so this is what is so fascinating about this situation in the lawsuits, is the information is really coming out about how the science was manipulated all along the way for 40 years with Monsanto scientists. There's evidence of ghostwriting studies, you know, commissioning certain studies, working with regulatory agencies to stop certain other agencies from studying glyphosate, just a hand in the pot the whole way in guiding how the science went. What happened in 2015, and that was an impetus for the many lawsuits, was that the World Health Organization's Cancer Research Agency, and this is a specialized group of cancer experts that are independent, that have the relevant expertise to review all of the published and peer-reviewed scientific studies on glyphosate. And they came out and said that they believe it's probably carcinogenic to humans. And that sent shockwaves. Monsanto wasn't even expecting that high of a cancer rating, but we can see in the documents that they were worried about these independent scientists looking at glyphosate. They had a whole PR plan ready to go before the report even came out. And again, they were expecting it to be a lesser designation. They were still worried. And the PR plan, which we now have, and it's posted on our website at usrtk.org. I've written several stories about this. It's a fascinating document. It lays out all of the industry partners that Monsanto planned to engage to orchestrate outcry about the cancer panel, to push the Monsanto point of view. And it says very clearly the goal of this plan was to protect the reputation and the freedom to operate of Roundup. And that is really what this whole conversation is about, is that these corporations have one goal and one goal only, and that's to protect their profits and their freedom to operate, doing business as they've always done, no matter what scientific evidence is coming out about their products. So we see from that, now from there unfolded, so we have like all these industry partners are named. And then, of course, we can track the industry partners, and it's various groups. Some of them are trade groups. Okay, we know those work with the chemical companies. Some of them, though, are front groups that appear to be independent. They don't look like they work with the chemical companies, but they're putting forth the same messaging. And the messaging was full-scale attacks on the scientists, you know, calling them liars, frauds, completely trying to discredit them, saying that they're, you know, motivated by profit, vanity, and greed. I mean, it's just really heavy-handed stuff. And all of those examples were just on a website called the Genetic Literacy Project, which, you know, has some sort of standing. I don't understand why, but some sort of standing of credibility among universities and scientists. And they actually have programs to train scientists and journalists in their type of communication. So it's a quite embedded system that we see here, going from the corporations to the PR firms to front groups to the universities, the top universities in the U.S. that are all speaking the same talking points to protect the agrochemical industry's products.
Mm-hmm. Why do people do this? I mean, why are they doing this?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I think about it a lot. Certainly there's money in it, but it's beyond that. Not, you know, so we track a lot of academics, for example, and some of them don't seem to be getting paid from Monsanto directly, but there's certainly a group mentality around it that has been whipped up. And I think this comes straight from the PR firms. And one of the things that's a new development that I think we'll get to later in this conversation is the information that's coming out about the PR firms that Bayer and Monsanto hired in 2013 to try to rehabilitate the image of their products. And this is mm-hmm. important. Now, this was before all this stuff came out about the independent cancer, you know, analysis of glyphosate before the trial.
Mm-hmm.
This was in 2013, and it was specifically driven by the GMO labeling campaigns. So you mentioned GMOs at the beginning, and I think it's really important to draw this line so clearly. The reason a lot of us were raising concerns about GMOs, and the reason it's very tied to all of this that we're talking about with Roundup, is that most of the GMOs in our food are engineered to tolerate Roundup. They're so-called Roundup-ready crops. So this is 80% of the 80 to 90%. I think it's upward toward 90 now percent of the corn and the soy grown in the United States are engineered so that you can spray Roundup all over them and they won't die, but the chemicals will kill the plants. So of course we have glyphosate in our food. We've seen glyphosate increase tremendously since GMOs were introduced in the mid-90s, almost 15-fold increase. So that's a major reason why I'm concerned about GMOs. And the companies were certainly concerned with consumers being worried about GMOs and trying to get them labeled. And so after mm-hmm. the California Ballot Initiative, which I worked on, I was the media director of that GMO labeling campaign in California. And mm-hmm. we lost that campaign, and the company spent $45 million to stop what had very high public support. And they did manage to crush it with a massive disinformation campaign. And after that, they got together, the agrochemical companies, and said, we've got to do something to try to win back the debate about our food
mm-hmm.
system. And they hired at that time the world's biggest PR firm, Fleischmann Hillard, and also Ketchum, two PR firms that have a long history of dastardly deeds. Like, both of them have been caught doing espionage. You know, Ketchum has worked for dictators. It used to be Russia's PR firm. I mean, they're really, really steeped in a long history of misleading and fooling the public with all kinds of sneaky tricks. And so Bayer chose the, and Monsanto both hired these firms and launched a a culture-wide campaign to take back the narrative about our food supply. And they succeeded in a lot of ways in convincing a lot of journalists and scientists that they're the ones that stand up for science. Yeah, and now it's not looking so good for them when it's all coming out that actually they waged serious, vicious attacks on scientists, right? So their pro-science view is we're pro anyone who is going to let us keep doing business as usual with the freedom to operate with our products. We're going to attack, shame, silence, try to discredit anyone who raises concerns about health and environmental impacts.
That's such an ironic thing. You know, we have in various places, people doing March for Science, and, you know, when we look over into, you know, the area of the environment and climate, you know, we have people in public office and who have, and media outlets, and therefore many Americans who, you know, basically quixotically reject the consensus of, you know, something like 95% of global climate scientists, who state that human activities are in fact, you know, principally things like obviously fossil fuel drilling, are influencing and changing our global ecology and therefore the weather and storm activities and floods and droughts and fires and all the rest of the things that are, you know, popping up and manifesting in more places. So there's a whole bunch, you know, there are people who just exist in denial about this, including, you know, the president himself, and then they use that denial as a rationale to keep doing business as usual. So from that perspective, it's quite understandable that, you know, people would want to take a stand for science, but then the whole matter becomes ambiguous. As it is in this instance, if in fact the science, in this case, you know, food, health, and agricultural science, is manipulated and, you know, and a false picture is put out there, I mean, how do you stand for science in that context? I mean, I personally, I don't know if you feel this way. I'm wondering if you do actually, Stacey. But, I mean, do you have any ambivalent feelings when you see people marching for science? Without, you know, a very sizable public frame of people really understanding that science can be subverted?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I think we need to be having a much deeper conversation about science in this country. It did bother me with some of the March for Science because the chemical companies were co-opting it. Like, they actually know of instances where they did not allow people to get up and speak about any concerns regarding GMOs and pesticides. I think what's going on, what I see, and I've read a lot of these documents and I've been reporting on and studying up on these PR campaigns, what I think is going on is that the corporations are waging just a full-on culture war against science across our society in many ways. And what the war is, and it's about, we're going to tell you what to think. And it's not actually going to be a conversation about science at all. It becomes a conversation about tribal identities. You know, the good people in this camp believe this way, and the bad, evil, anti-science activists are over here, or whatever the terms are to describe these tribal identities. I think this is where a lot of the academics got caught up. They thought, well, I'm getting attacked by somebody concerned about GMOs on Twitter, or somebody was rude to me or raised questions I didn't want to answer. Therefore, I'm persecuted, and all of those people that are raising concerns are now lumped into a group of nutty activists or whatever. I mean, it was very easy. We see examples of this in the emails of just sort of, you know, playing on these emotions of people to feel like they need to fight back against this enemy. And the entire truth about science is getting lost in the mix because the truth is that it is complicated. I mean, there certainly is. I mean, when it comes to climate, it's not complicated. We know that humans are causing climate change, and we know that we have to curb the use of fossil fuels drastically in order to survive on this planet. The science around chemicals is not ever going to be that certain and that, you know, much of a 98% of scientists marching one way in consensus. It's not that way. It's what we do have is decades of evidence pointing out all kinds of health effects with the pesticides that we spray on our foods. What we do know is that many other countries, based on that science, have already banned a lot of the chemicals that are in the food supply in the U.S. right now. Farmers already can grow food without those chemicals. And we're not just talking about glyphosate. It's hundreds of other pesticides. And we do know through recent studies that if you eat an organic diet, you can drastically reduce the pesticides in your body very quickly. So one of the themes that we see in the PR campaigns is an attack on organic food, attempts to shame and silence, you know, women who did the organic mommy mafia, you know, these sorts of things that, again, part of the culture war. Let's get women fighting with women about what food they feed their children, which, of course, really plays on emotions. Let's make it about anything except what this science is actually showing, which is that there are many, many, many health concerns related to the pesticides that we're all exposed to now and in the last 30 years, more than has ever happened in human history before. So, yes, there's something going on with pesticides in our food, with chemicals in the products in our homes, and the chemical companies know it. And so this is not the first time. This is the recent example, Bayer, Monsanto. What did they know when? Covering up the science, juries getting mad about it because the evidence is there. They knew, they didn't warn. And, of course, that's happened again and again in the chemical industry, knowing and not warning with various chemicals that are profitable, and so they protect them as long as they can.
You know, and, you know, it's kind of a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and then you have a real problem. You know, I don't know, and maybe you do, and maybe no one yet has weighed in on this, but, you know, the people in the trial were kind of experiencing long-term, persistent, and ongoing kind of up-close exposure. And, you know, they developed, I mean, this disease, you know, glyphosate chemical functions in the body in such a way as, you know, this is, you know, it's leading to this. Are there any studies underway, or is there anyone analyzing what the kind of now, unfortunately, normalized or routine exposures to glyphosate, you know, in breakfast cereals and, you know, other, you know, it's widely present in food products. I mean, you know, we're kind of eating it, hoping that, you know, maybe we won't be the one or something. I'm not eating it, but, you know, some people are because it's cheap. It's, you know, it's affordable. It's present. It's being pushed on us. It's what's available. But, you know, are there any studies afoot, or does anyone have a handle on, you know, what this ongoing lower-grade dosing of the population with glyphosate and these other chemicals that you mentioned, you know, is doing to people's health?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And because I do have info on that, and you're right that the cancer trials are about and involving people who've had long-term repeated exposures for a long time or high exposures. And so that's what the science is concerned about regarding cancer, is those long-term exposures. But there are many other health effects associated with glyphosate at much lower doses. We do have a fact sheet on our website about glyphosate health concerns that just runs down these studies. And there are many that are very recent, quite a few looking at low-dose exposures to glyphosate and finding links to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is one of the big ones. So concerns about liver disease. Concerns also about reproductive health effects, and then a last one, and I think this is possibly the most concerning of all, is altering of the gut microbiota. So really, you know, glyphosate was developed as an antibiotic. It's an antibacterial agent, rather. And so it could be interfering with the gut bacteria, which I think, you know, health research is starting to show really is a key part of overall health of people if we don't have our gut bacteria in a healthy state. So low levels of the chemical could be impacting us in various different ways. And I think for me, I think especially it's a concern for children. And it's not only a concern with the GMOs, because glyphosate is used in lots of foods. For example, wheat products. I think one of the biggest problems with glyphosate is farmers are using it in a method they call desiccation. And what that is spraying glyphosate over the wheat, all of the wheat crop, right before it's harvested, so that the wheat all is ready to be harvested at the same time. It essentially kills the wheat uniformly, then they can harvest it. But that's like right before, you know, that's getting processed into our food, so likely to be higher levels of glyphosate in wheat products. So that's something that I do try to buy organic, especially for kids. And then there are also studies showing glyphosate may be linked to impacts on bees and butterflies. So, you know, you said at the beginning about how we're all interconnected and our planet is a system. And the system is all that also involves our bodies and our health. You know, the same chemicals running through the waterways are running through our own bodies. And so I think that's the conversation we need to be having about science. What knowledge can we take from science to guide us in making better decisions? And when we see lots of evidence of harmful impacts of the most widely used herbicide in the history of the world, glyphosate, like, it's time to say, how do we do things differently? And I think a lot of people are noting that, and stores, retailers, farmers, governments are looking to what can we do to shift our food and farming practices away from these chemicals.
They are. So they're kind of getting the message, and they're trying to come up with something because, you know, a new day is dawning. Is there any sense of what is happening to bear? I mean, many, you know, common sense would dictate if, you know, there's this company that is at the center of a very long-standing scientific debate and conflict, and, you know, they're encroaching on people's right to know what's in their food in order to push their products, whatever the health effects might be. You know, this has been ongoing for a while, and so common sense would dictate, why would Bayer buy this company? And, you know, was that a misstep on their part? Are they that callous that they don't care? Well, we can't read their minds. But what is going on with Bayer? I mean, do you think right now people are, you know, within the company are sitting there saying, well, that was a good decision, I, you know, no regrets, or, you know, what's going on with that?
I would love to know. I mean, yeah, a lot of people are asking that question that you just posed. Why did Bayer buy Monsanto? They are certainly suffering from it now. They've lost massive stock value. It was 30%. Now it's maybe even closer to 50%. The CEO is under fire. They've just recently, in the last week, which I want to talk about in a minute, have tried to backtrack from all their, you know, the PR hysteria that they created in 2013. There's a lot of backtracking and making up to do for that. It's not going to happen overnight. I don't know if they ever can win back the trust of people. But, you know, why did they buy this company? I think they believed their own bull. I really think they were so successful at spinning a fable about what they were doing and what they were trying to do that they believed their own story. They believed that the science was going to be strong enough to save them from these trials, and the juries are just not having it. And I should say, because an important part of this history, too, and their big defense is that regulatory agencies, the EPA in Germany and Europe, have said that glyphosate is safe. It's not a carcinogen. But the problem for Bayer and what's been coming out in the trials is the documents showing what a hand they had in those regulatory decisions. For example, the report that came out of the German regulatory authority was supposedly, you know, this completely comprehensive best science. Well, somebody did a plagiarism analysis on it and found that it was half written by Monsanto. They wrote whole sections of reports that were used by regulatory agencies to make decisions. And so that's probably the most disturbing thing to come out, is how much control and influence they have on government agencies that are supposed to be protecting public health.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's not working.
As you've tracked this whole issue over many years, I mean, there was evidence in the past that science, you know, within the FDA and elsewhere, you know, internal scientists, government scientists were having a problem, were questioning some of these findings, and were kind of told to, you know, kind of shut up, basically, or they were fired. You know, there's a whole history of that. So, you know, people like you who've been following me, you know, the whole content of, like, what science has been done for a long time, you know, must have had suspicions. I mean, all along, didn't Monsanto actually try to withhold access to its seeds to prevent anyone independent and not in their employ from studying the health effects?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I just want to mention that on the question of genetically engineered foods, they've certainly controlled the science all along the way because of the patents.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone that's just believing what they say about the science is very naive. But on the glyphosate mm-hmm. issue, you're right. Going back decades, we can see, you know, EPA, people in EPA that tried to raise concerns, sidelines, other people in EPA stopping other government agencies from doing studies that they thought might find health effects. Various ways of manipulating what went on behind the scenes in the regulatory agencies. And now, of course, in the U.S., we've got, I think, a rising awareness of how much the government is actually working for the corporations and not for the people. And so when the EPA
right.
came out with a recent study saying, you know, hey, we've looked at all this, glyphosate is not a carcinogen, and it barely even caused a blip in the media,
mm-hmm.
Well, because I think the media is waking up to the fact that the Trump EPA is in service to the chemical company. And mm-hmm. it's not just Trump, by the way. It was Obama. It was everyone before him. Obama had many Monsanto friends in high levels of influence in government. But it has reached, I think, in the Trump era, a new level of brazenness and just openly flaunting, we're going to use government agencies as to help promote and market, you know, hazardous products so that people keep buying them. It's just people aren't buying it anymore. So it's an interesting time, I think, for science and for the public and for the media to really be called to task and say, you've got to provide more honest coverage of this. You know, I see a lot of evidence of confusion in the media, people not identifying front groups, constantly quoting mm-hmm. academics that we know work with Monsanto without disclosing those conflicts, all sorts of different ways that sort of make the these products or safe lines seem and sound more authoritative than it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it's
mm-hmm.
it's a PR war against science. There's no other way to put it. And I think we've got to start to clear the smoke and really hold the media more accountable and, you know, share the true sources of information. That's what we're trying to do at U.S. Right to Know. And we're
mm-hmm.
reporting all this with documents, with backup, with facts about how all this playbook operated.
Yeah, because, you know, if they keep sending the material to scientists and somehow that's condoned, to reporters, and that's condoned and not questioned, and no one says look into it further, then they in effect get schooled in their arguments. And you know, in the past, one might have expected, back when there was, we don't even want to say objectivity, but some attempt to look at, the issue comprehensively, that reporters might have done further due diligence. But either they're lazy, they don't have time, they don't have interest, they've been indoctrinated, or the editors and publishers are basically, we don't value if you spend your time in this particular way. And therefore, the due diligence that the government agencies should be doing, that the press should be doing, isn't happening. And to the contrary, as you detail in your recent article, they are basically making up friends and enemy lists and, feeding whatever nonsense they've devised for dissemination by the friends, and then attacking the people that are actually doing the authentic work and, as enemies. What kind of level of effort economically was it for them to be doing all of this?
Well, that was a good summary. Certainly there's tens of millions of dollars going into a year going into front groups and disinformation campaigns around our food. But I wanted to talk about this recent example because, and what you just said is all true. The media is under fire in so many ways. Reporters get pressure from their editors. Certain stories don't get the space. They're super busy and being manipulated in so many different ways. I think the extent of it is something that a lot of journalists or media still aren't seeing or haven't accepted, that so many people could be telling me a false story. But I just wanted to read this. There was just and the French media is doing an amazing job of just busting all of this out, and we really don't see the kind of stories that are being reported in France in the high-level U.S. media. We do in some cases. The New York Times has done some good work, The Intercept, of course, some others. But this is from a recent French story, false journalists, fake scientists, false studies, fake farmers. Now if you've got journalists, scientists, studies, and farmers all telling you the same thing, you're probably going to believe it's true. But in fact, there are examples of all of those that you can trace right back to Monsanto's PR campaigns, deploying journalists, giving talking points to scientists, ghostwriting the studies, and setting up fake farmer groups, all to move the PR narrative that this stuff is safe and fine. So, how do we help people break out of the propaganda grip and see what's real and question critically? And that's something I think about a lot, too, because one of the other aspects of this is, what students in universities are hearing. And many students in universities in the U.S. who are studying agriculture or agrochemicals or genetic engineering are not hearing about concerns. They're not hearing about conflicts and questions in the science. They're just hearing you must be, that to be pro-pesticide and pro-genetic engineering is to be pro-science, and anybody else who doesn't think so is just completely not even worth listening to. That's so dangerous. So I really urge students to ask questions, to find, do your own research, find sources of information you can trust, and look into these documents. They're an incredibly valuable resource of how corporations actually operate. The playbook is just being exposed. And we've seen all this before, of course, with tobacco, with climate change, and one of the, I think other things we have to grapple with is we know now, that most reasonable people know that the climate science is strong and indisputable, and we must change our practices around fossil fuels. But even knowing that, we're still debating science. Reporters are still allowing stories to be framed like people disagree on the science. No, we need to have stories about how to change policy, about how to make systemic changes that will save and protect our health, our families, and our future. So how do we shift the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, that's really important question. Yeah. I mean, how do, you know, it seems from my perspective like there's a whole swath of people that have been following this all along, really understand it, are very concerned and outraged by it. It's like both for the sake of our food supply, our health, our environment, as well as our economy, you know, is now, you know, kind of this process that's poisoning, you know, people has like this entrenched hold, you know, and how do we loosen it? And then there's another segment of the population where, you know, they're kind of see no evil, hear no evil, or maybe, you know, sadly, this is all I can afford, so I don't even really want to know about this because I can't so readily access and all, you know, the healthy foods. And, of course, all of this is happening just at the time when healthy foods are, you know, organic foods are under attack by, you know, the Trump administration and, of course, the DARC Act, which, you know, killed labeling, deny Americans the right to know. This was signed into law by Obama. So, you know, we have multiple administrations, and yet somehow our, you know, I mean, and it's true that we have a lot of important fronts to fight on, but the food front, even though it really affects everybody, because of the divide between the organic food, which, you know, the food people are concerned about, and everyone else eating the poisoned food, you know, there's kind of a gap in people calling for a change, although, you know, Bernie Sanders has recently spoken out and called for a change and plans a change in terms of agriculture if he is elected, if and when he's elected. And, of course, I've reported on that repeatedly. But, I mean, where do you see with this complete clarity about what's been going on, where do you see expanding your efforts so that, you know, more people are really on board to change this?
Right. Well, I think that the number of people who get it right now about climate change, about what's going on with our food system, is plenty of people to make the changes that we need to change if we get focused on what really needs to happen, which is massive, sweeping systemic changes. But it's so exciting to me that Bernie is talking about the stuff he's talking about, that Elizabeth Warren is out there saying we need to break up big agriculture. You know, Tulsi Gabbard came out and said we should be looking into banning glyphosate. I mean, this is a phenomenal shift in the political debate at the highest levels. I'm so glad to see so many women running for office, and they're talking about real issues. I think that's such an important step forward, and it's going to take a focused grassroots movement to take our government back from the corporations. It really is, and that's the debate we need to be having in 2020. You know, of course, we need to, the Trump and all of the cronies he put in literally to destroy the agencies of our government. They've been upfront about that. They've not tried to hide it. We're going to put people in charge of education, in charge of labor, in charge of the environment, who hate public education, hate labor unions, and hate the and want to destroy the EPA. I mean, let's back off. You know, we need to stop that bleeding. And we need to to heal the patient, the U.S. government, and really, you know, figure out how we can create a government in this country that works for the people and that protects people's health. And I think that the plans being discussed by people like Bernie really get at that, and it's exciting. So, you know, I think that a big purpose of the PR campaigns is to create so much noise and confusion, shame, fear, silence people because they're so afraid of the power of people. They, all of the, you know, the tobacco tactics from the tobacco industry, from the oil industry, from the pesticide industry, they're all geared for the same thing, which is to keep their products unregulated, to stop governments from putting restrictions on toxic products, stop independent science, to stop transparency so that we don't know what's going on. So we just have to stand clearly and loudly for transparency, for precaution, for independent science, and for restricting, not allowing companies to harm and hurt people. No, you can't make a profit harming and hurting people. Find another way to make money. That's my prescription.
Yeah, you know, it's funny the way you said it, too, because, you know, there's something in your intonation, and, you know, people were like, oh, you know, the mommy bloggers and this and that. But, you know, one of the things is that, you know, respect for the instincts and natural, you know, protective instincts and ways of communicating that, you know, moms and dads and parents and people, you know, who have that, you know, kind of sense in their heart or whatever, have, you know, which is you just don't let someone who's immature, child developed, you know, who doesn't quite know, of course, these people obviously do know, you know, you don't just let them run amok. You know, you have to curb it. It doesn't necessarily have to be outraged and angry. It's a protective thing. And, you know, it should be respected. It's one reason why we need to respect, honor, and, you know, treat with justice and equity women, you know, because we've been, you know, the traditional holders of this tradition of, you know, benevolent parenting rather than, you know, hostile, vicious, and dissociated, sociopathic parenting. And, you know, one thing that also has often struck me is, like, the English, because of their royal system, you know, are, you know, if a maternal figure says no, you know, they're more inclined to listen and kind of go along with it than in this country. You know, we would do well to respect those instincts. Rather, even when we're trying to make a change, assuming that it's always, you know, kind of more the warrior male way that's in charge, even though it takes considerable warriorship to be doing the initiatives that you and the U.S. Right to Know have been doing and other, you know, food advocacy organizations have been doing because, you know, it's facing off with powerful players. So I think it's really fantastic that it's come this far. Now, you know, for listeners to the show, if you could tell them something that they could do that would be helpful, that they could tell their friends to do, you know, or a new understanding that they should carry about all of this from all of these things that we've been discussing that have transpired, you know, what would that be?
Oh, that's a lot right there that you just said, which I loved the information you were just sharing about the importance of women. So I want to say one thing about that first, which is that women and moms are the biggest problem, the biggest problem that the Monsantos and the Bayers and the food companies are facing right now. And they don't know how to handle it. And I think this is a huge advantage. And what I mean by that is that women are buying most of the food. 80 to 90% of food are bought by women, bought by moms. Moms were a huge force behind the GMO labeling campaigns, besides concerns about pesticides, because they see kids with allergies. They know we're experiencing health problems that, you know, our parents and their parents didn't experience. So women, I think, are really waking up across the board. They're changing the way they buy food. They're buying more organic. All demographics, all income levels, all races are buying organic at similar levels. They're all increasing their buying organics. And so this has the food companies really in a crisis. Like the press coverage is sort of hilarious that I see about just the drama in the food industry, like the trade associations breaking apart, CEOs are leaving. They, you know, headlines in the Wall Street Journal like food companies don't know what people want to eat. Well, what people want to eat is healthy, pure food that's grown in ways that are responsible, that doesn't include a lot of chemicals, that is healthy and whole. But a lot of the people are making decisions in the food industry. And I mean on all levels. So the CEOs, the marketing departments, the PR firms, the front groups, most of these are run by men. And they're trying to figure out how can we convince these women. So how they go about it, typical way, sort of the part of the mail order thing you were just describing, you know, belittle them, tell them that they don't know what they're talking about, tell them that they need to listen to the experts. So we just see part of the PR noise is these sort of really awkward and painful attempts to shame and whip up disagreements among women. Like I mentioned, the organic mommy mafia. That was a headline in the New York Post. It was the tyranny of the organic mommy mafia. And it was how we can't stand these moms nagging at us to eat organic food. And who did they quote in that story? Well, Front Roots, pesticide industry, this group called the Independent Women's Forum, which is funded by the Koch brothers and defends tobacco, you know, denies climate change and partners with Monsanto. So, okay, just no, no, no. I think put women in charge. If I were a food company CEO or one of these PR firms, I would be thinking, we have to get women into these institutions in droves. We have to get people of color into these institutions in droves. It's time to address the inequity in all levels of our society, because it is all related. I mean, as you said, so what people can do, there's so many things we can do, and I think that people can really just start where you're at being a leader in your own community, among your own friends and family, to speak out and make sure that people have the information that, you know, pesticides have lots of different health concerns, and it's possible to buy food without them, and everybody deserves access to that food. So how can we create local food systems that are robust? We need to anyway because of climate change. So what can we do in our own communities? Make your own, grow your own, start your own companies, support people who do. I think a first step, and because there's so many things we need to do, right, it's basically recreate all levels of our society to work for people instead of for the corporations. But the first line of defense, I think, and this is why I'm working for U.S. Right to Know, and it's just a small part of it, but it's an important part, is transparency. And this information sharing, just get the facts out. So we try to make it easy for people to find facts, to sort through the documents. We have all the Monsanto papers from the trials posted on our website and many of our own documents that we've gotten through Freedom of Information. We write fact sheets about all the key players in the propaganda campaigns. We have a weekly newsletter that recaps food news for our health. So it's just a short weekly email that you'd get with the latest news from our investigation, from the trials, from mainstream media reporting about really important science and health information about our food. So you can find all that at usrtk.org, and you can sign up for our newsletter at usrtk.org/signup.
That's great. Thank you. You know, it never happens, but I would like to hear some of the people who were poo-pooing all of this. You know, instead they will, you know, some of them will turn around and cover it. And, you know, I hope there's some acknowledgement, too, because, you know, you hold power when you tell people that people concerned about, you know, the food supply are kind of full of it. You know, you're kind of cutting yourself off from, you know, the sustenance we all need, and it shouldn't be done, you know, carelessly or cavalierly. You know, what do things look like going forward for Monsanto? I mean, you know, it's kind of like there are thousands of other people lined up ready to sue them for the same problem. I mean, what is their forward-looking trajectory in the aftermath of these judgments and these revelations?
Right. Well, you know, we don't know. As you said, thousands of more people suing them. The federal judge in the case has said that they need to enter negotiations for a settlement. So I think we will see a settlement at some point. I don't know when or how much. Certainly new trials are gearing up. My colleague Carrie Gillum has the Monsanto Roundup trial tracker, where she's doing continual updates about the trial dates coming up, who the plaintiffs are. We know the lawyers have said they've only released a small part of the documents that they actually have. So as trials go forward, more documents will come out. And I think we're starting to see that in many other ways. This recent scandal in France, which you mentioned, where it came out that one of the PR firms that Bayer and Monsanto work with had kept detailed lists of 200 people, most of them journalists, and these lists had, you know, detailed personal information, contact information, their positions on pesticides, their level of engagement. I mean, just like the everything you want to know about these people. And people are really mad about this in France, but that came about because of a whistleblower at one of the PR firms. So, you know, people are out there sitting on with access to lots of information that we hope to see will come out, because the public has a right to know how all of these games work behind the scenes, and we really need to clear up all of the confusion and the PR tricks and dirty trick deceptions, and really just have an honest conversation about our food system and what the options are going forward to break the addiction to chemicals and figure out how we can have diverse, resilient, hardy, you know, food systems that will be able to withstand and deal with climate change.
Amen to that. I mean, the thing is that, you know, here we have a moment in time where, due to, you know, the opening provided by the need to coalesce strongly to remove the current regime of completely sold out and bought out and industry favorable over health, so-called elected officials and everything who are not acting in the public good, here we have the opportunity to gather in large numbers and, you know, move on from that. And then some people are as a way for that to happen, and then if it does happen, which may or may not, you know, we may or may not be successful, you know, there are some people who want to use that opening to say, you know, we have to begin to address things correctly. We want to make some changes. We want to shift some things. And then there are other people who are like, we want to go back to the way it was, you know, because it's been so destabilizing. You know, what do you say to people who want to go back rather than, you know, seeing right away the need to shift these infrastructures, difficult though it may be, and to somehow move forward to a more healthful system?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think people have trouble seeing the solutions. They have trouble seeing an economy that doesn't involve corporations doing whatever they want, because we're so used to that in the U.S. I mean, I think, you know, we got to turn off the TV, stop listening to the constant droning of fear-based confusion and noise, and really just spend time with families and friends and in our communities and find information sources we can trust. And share those with the people who trust us. I mean, it's basic steps. You're right that we may never be able to fix and change this, but what choice do we have but to try? What choice do we have? Of course we can have and create a food system that has a first priority of providing healthy food to people, and rather than a first priority of enriching a small number of shareholders. Of course we can do that, but it's going to take a lot of creative solutions and building trust with our partners and in our communities. I think that's the place to start. And to raise the next generation. And I think the next generation does see you know, that they are going to need to step up and take on these challenges in a big way and reimagine everything.
I think that's a terrific concluding point for our show today. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Stacey Malkin of U.S. Right to Know about the new developments and revelations about the health impact and viability of GMO foods and glyphosate, thanks to recent lawsuits. If you've enjoyed the show, listeners, please pass it along, share it, and it can be found later in the show archives for people that have missed this live, you know, kind of outreach of it. Thank you so much, Stacey Malkin, for being with us again. Listeners, you can support her organization at www.usrtk.org for U.S. Right to Know. And, you know, thank you so much for your great work. It's really awesome, and it's really bearing fruit.
Well, thank you, Allison. I really appreciate it, and for your work as well, for speaking out about the truth for so many years as you have. I really appreciate following you as well on social media, because you're always raising important, deeper points about the things that we need to be addressing and dealing with. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And thank you, listeners. You can follow me on social media at either Allison Rose Levy, you know, on Twitter, or on Facebook, Connecting the Dots for Health, which is my public page for the kinds of, you know, kind of news and contemplation and conversation that we do on the show, also doing it on social media. Thank you for being with us this week on Connect the Dots, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.